Tonight we're going to talk about a vineyard. And okay, it will be. And this is called part one because there's a parallel. The message tonight's going to be from Isaiah chapter 5. And then next week, it's going to come from the book of Matthew. The chapter's escaping me now because I'm getting old. But Jesus, Yeshua the Messiah, picks up the analogy of the vineyard and actually uses the exact same words, well, more or less, that Isaiah uses. And the lesson is, well, we're going to get into the lesson. But before we get into the lesson, I want to put in an advertisement for the Bessara Institute. Bessara is the Hebrew word for good news. The New Testament's actually called the Brit Hadashah, which is the New Testament, but it can also be called the Bessara because it's good news. But BessaraInstitute.org is a place where you can go and take courses. There is a charge for the courses. It isn't free, but there's a minimal charge for the courses. And I'm going to be teaching another course there starting in about 2 weeks. And then if you're familiar with Messianic Lamb TV, radio, I can't remember the exact. You guys know about Messianic Lamb. I'm going to start a show on there this coming Thursday at 7 p.m. I'll have to email you the thing. I think it's called messianiclamb.tv or lamb.tv. It's something like that. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll email it. Well, it matters if you want to look for it, I guess. But and it's of course, also on YouTube. So that's enough of an advertisement. And yeah, the radio show is still on Sunday nights at 7:30. But let's get back to the vineyard. Now, one thing I have to say about vineyards, some of you, first of all, we have two new people here, and I forgot to explain that we learned some Hebrew words here. And sometimes we call Jesus Yeshua, which was his Hebrew name. And why is it that it's important to learn some Hebrew? So when we get to heaven, we won't have culture shock. Anyway, Rabbi Walter Lieber used to say that all the time. You guys probably know him, but I still miss him, even though he's been gone for 12 years already. Not dead, he moved to Florida. To the promised land. Although right now, he's probably the one laughing at us. But anyway, but you may be familiar with vineyard churches. Some of you are. There's a movement within Christianity called the Vineyard. It wasn't supposed to be a denomination. It kind of turned into a denomination over the years. And you young people would really like it because the music is really good. But John Wimber, who was kind of the founder of the movement, named it the Vineyard because he said a vineyard exemplifies everything there is to know about Christianity. You know, you plow the ground, you clear the stones, you plant the grape vines, you pull the weeds, you water it, you take care of it. And then at the end, it bears fruit. And you go and you pick the grapes. And grapes, of course, were very, very important in the Middle East, very important in the whole Mediterranean area. In fact, I was reading a thing a few years ago about Roman soldiers hated to be stationed someplace where there weren't grapes and figs and olives growing. They didn't like the Holy Land, though, because of the people, not because of the food. But anyway, so the vineyard has everything in it, and this is what's going to make the analogy, I hope, hit home. So did we lose the PowerPoint? Uh-oh. Maybe we'll reboot it. Anybody know any good jokes? So this priest, minister, and a rabbi walk in. No. Here we go. So what this is going to show is how God plants a vineyard expecting to get fruit. You know, nobody plants a vineyard to say, aren't those nice grape plants? Nobody plants fig trees and says, oh, we just plant them because they're pretty trees. In ancient times, in an agricultural society, you planted fig trees because you wanted figs. You planted vineyards because you wanted grapes, either to eat, to make wine. And yes, they made wine. So I don't want to hear about they didn't ferment things and they made real wine. Jesus made really good wine and everybody drank wine. So we'll get that out of the way. But God expects fruit, just like people who planted the vineyards and orchards expected fruit. So John the Baptist says, you guys don't produce fruit. And when a tree doesn't produce fruit, the axe is laid to the root of the tree. And after the tree's cut down, it's thrown into the fire. They didn't want decorative trees. They wanted food. We plant, decorative stuff in our yards, and that's okay because we don't, we can go to Giant Eagle and buy grapes if we want them. But he expects fruit. If you're, I don't know, I don't want to name a thing, but if you're 90 years old and you say, oh, I got saved when I was 15 and I met Jesus when I was 15, but since then I've just been sitting in my family room watching TV. That's not what he expects you to do. He expects you to bear fruit. And so when we get to this vineyard, we're going to Isaiah chapter 5. My favorite major prophet. His Hebrew name is Yeshayahu, but we won't get into that. Joan always tells me if you start calling people by their Hebrew names, then nobody knows who you're talking about and everybody gets confused. Ooh, this is a tough crowd. Oh yeah, Jordan is in here. Yeah, yesterday morning was bad at the Torah class. Not a single person laughed at a single joke. Because, well, you guys weren't there and you're... But anyway, Isaiah 5:1. Let me sing for my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. Now, this is God talking through Isaiah. Okay? Let me sing for my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? This is actually talking about Jesus. This is actually talking about Yeshua. When God says, my beloved, it's his vineyard, he's talking about Jesus. This is a messianic foretelling. Okay. Jesus actually plants the vineyard. Next week we're going to find out how the church is a vineyard. And if it bears fruit, it's great. If it doesn't bear fruit, we're going to see what happens. So it's addressed to Jesus, who's his beloved, and he has a vineyard. He has a vineyard. And it's his vineyard, it says. He's not renting the vineyard from somebody, it's his vineyard. In the book of Hebrews, it talks about how Moses is a servant. So Moses is a servant of the house. Jesus is the son, capital S, of the house. He's the owner of the house because his father owns the house. Moses just works as a servant in the house. So this is his vineyard. And so this talks about the great things God had done for his people. When you read through the Torah, especially the deliverance from Egypt, and I should say, if you've, everybody always asks me, how can I take the Torah class? How can I do the Torah class? Well, there's some people here that are doing it now. I think you like it, right? But there's a new YouTube page called The Torah Class, and there's 15 out of the 33 sessions are already up. The 16th session will probably be up sometime tomorrow. And so it's simply called The Torah Class. But as you go read through the Torah, especially when the people are delivered from Egypt, you see how God tells them to do something and then delivers them sovereignly with a strong right arm, it keeps saying, with a strong right arm. They didn't deliver themselves. Pharaoh didn't just let them go. God keeps hardening Pharaoh's heart. In other words, he makes it more difficult. And why is that? So they realize that God is delivering us. It's not we're delivering ourselves or Pharaoh's letting us go. It's kind of like when Gideon started with 30 some thousand men and God cuts it down to 300. And God says, okay, that's just the right number of men. And Gideon's probably thinking, well, wait a minute. I don't know how you guys fight battles in heaven, but down here, the more guys you have, the better. And I had 30 some thousand guys. Now I got 300 guys. But God says, now you're going to see that I'm the one who's going to win the victory. I'm the one who's fighting. So without any of those soldiers firing a single arrow or throwing a spear, they won the battle. But that's a different lesson. So he's done great things for his people. And you can see in this, his people are set apart. It's a vineyard. It has a wall around it. We're going to see next week the church has a wall around it. Now we've taken down the wall and we invite the barbarians to come in and we invite the uncultivated stuff to come in because, after all, we want people to like us. So we want to be just like the world. Yeah, we don't really mean all that stuff we used to say. We're cool. We want you to come here and have some fun. We don't want to be like judgmental or anything, but the people are set apart, right? God makes a covenant with Israel. Nobody else had the covenant. Nobody else had a God who spoke to them and made things happen. The Egyptians even said, why? We got hundreds of gods, and not a one of them can do all this stuff that we've seen the God of the Hebrews do. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But they were the only ones who knew the true God. He gave them an agreement, a covenant of law that bound them to him. Bound them to him. The closest thing on earth to a covenant is a marriage, where you have two people joined together in an intimate way that are bound to each other. It's not a contract, it's not an agreement, it's not, well, if I decide to leave, I'll take the TV set, this couch, and the bird, and you can have the rest of it. Or, not supposed to be that. I mean, I know sometimes it is, but a covenant, a marriage on earth is the closest thing because through the whole Bible, there's a bridal paradigm, how God is married to the people. God says, I who am your creator, have become your husband. This is why he talks about Israel committing adultery when they go after other gods. The church is called the bride of Christ. That's been a term since ancient times because we're married to him in a covenant way. Heaven's called the marriage supper of the Lamb. We're going to get invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. How cool is that? I can't wait to see the buffet. I'm sure there'll be donuts in there somewhere, but there'll be a lot of cooler food than that. So these people were set apart on a fruitful hill. In other words, the ground was fertile. Everything was going to be given to them so that the fruit would come. Now, Isaiah, of course, is writing 700 years before Jesus is even born. Okay? This is why I love Isaiah. He prophesies things like 700 years ahead of time. He talks about the suffering Messiah. He talks about how the virgin will be with child. He talks about how the light's going to come into Galilee. He talks about how the Messiah is going to suffer and all our sins are going to be put on him 700 years before it actually happens. How cool is that? We got quote prophets on TV. I don't know if you've seen any of these guys, but they're on TV prophesying stuff all the time that never happens. And they still say, well, in our prophetic ministry, it's, well, Deuteronomy 18 says, what you do with a false prophet, you throw him out of the community. But That's also another story. So it's on a fruitful hill. The ground is perfect. The rest of the world's not cultivated. They don't have a covenant with God. Israel does. Next week, we're going to see the church does. The rest of the world is not cultivated. The rest of the world are us dirty, unclean Gentiles who were non-covenant people. So in as you go through the Old Testament, you see even Jesus sometimes says, oh, you just treat that guy like a Gentile then. You know, Jesus called the Gentile, the Syrophoenician woman, a dog. That's what they used to call Gentiles. Jews hated dogs. Middle Easterners in general hate dogs. They feel dogs are like scavengers and they live off of them and they don't like dogs. In ancient times, nobody had dogs. So they called Gentiles dogs because they were out of covenant. We were out of covenant. They weren't supposed to hang out with us. They weren't supposed to associate with Gentiles. They weren't supposed to marry them. They weren't supposed to do business with them. And most importantly, they weren't supposed to go to church with them. And this is what led to the so much downfall, is they would Israeli men would take foreign wives who were pagans and say, well, why don't you come to our temple? We got a cool God too. I mean, your God's probably pretty cool, but we got a cool God too. Well, sure, I'll go check it out. So the rest of the world wasn't cultivated. They were the only ones that had the agreement, right? All the people around them worshiped hundreds of gods, hundreds of them. And you had to try to figure out what each god wanted, and there were all these stories, and you had to learn all this, what we call mythology. That was their religion. So the Israelites had the relationship. And the relationship was not only the law, but they had the scripture. Moses wrote down the books of the Torah while they were wandering in the wilderness. Before that, there was no scripture. All there was circumcision and some vague sacrifice stuff and some information about keeping the Sabbath. When the law comes, there's 613 laws that God binds the people to himself with. And if you follow all 613, then you're in. If you violate any of them, you're out. And there's only 613, so good luck with that. Where's Jordan? So they had the scriptures, they had the prophets, they had the Sabbath, the Shabbat, the feasts. You know, the Sabbath is actually a feast. The Shabbat is a feast. When you see the feast mentioned, the Shabbat is always mentioned first. You know, in Exodus, I can't remember if it's 30 or 31, so don't get mad at me out there in TV land. I think it's 31, but there's a song that's still sung in the synagogues called Vishamru that means the children of Israel have to keep the Sabbath. It's the covenant between me and them. If they don't do anything else, they got to keep the Sabbath. In fact, an observant Jew is defined as somebody who keeps the Sabbath. So how do you keep the Sabbath? You don't work. You rest. You pray. You spend time with your family. You take a nap. You go to synagogue in the morning, of course. Or in those days, the temple in the morning. Then the rest of the day, you rest. And you do family things. You don't say, well, you know what? I didn't finish putting up that fence over there. So I guess Saturday afternoon, I'll go out there. So they had the Sabbath. They had all the feast days. All these things as we went through that prefigure the Messiah. I think you guys are starting to see in the Torah how many things prefigure the Messiah, how many mediators there were, how many people stood between the people and God. And they were prefigurements of Jesus, who stands between the people and God. He's the only mediator. Paul tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 2, there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. There's not 58, there's not seven, there's not even two, there's one. So the people had all these things, and they had his special protection. They were always under his eye. He called Israel the apple of my eye. Isn't it interesting in Hebrew that the word for apple and the word for pupil, like the pupil of your eye, are the same word? So God says, Israel's the apple of my eye. In fact, I always see him. He says in Isaiah, 40-something. I think it's 45 or 49, you guys probably know. But God says, he's talking about Jerusalem and says, your walls are always before me. In fact, in other words, he always sees where his people are. He always sees Jerusalem. The walls are always before him. He said, and if you think, you know, he says, you know, can a mother abandon her baby? No, she won't. But even if she does, I'm never going to abandon you. I have your names written on the palm of my hand, which carries over to us as believers in Jesus. He has our names written in the palm of his hand, you know, kind of like in the book of life. He's not going to forget about us. He's going to look at his hand and say, oh, yeah, I remember Joe over there. Yeah, oh, yeah, I remember Joe over there. And so his special protection always under his eye. Look at all the battles they fought in the wilderness. When they got to the land, they won every battle. 1948, the day Israel was declared a state, proclaimed a state, they were attacked from all sides by four Arab armies. And they won. 1956, the Suez War, totally outnumbered, overwhelmed, they won. 1967, attacked from both sides by five different countries, outnumbered 100-1, or no more than that, probably 1,000-1, they won. 1973, totally overwhelmed, Yom Kippur War. They're worshiping Yom Kippur, the Arabs attack. 3-4 days later, they have to have a truce because the Israeli soldiers are almost in Cairo and almost in Damascus. Somebody's watching out for them. The next war, which is going to be soon, I think, with Iran. I mean, they're all ready for that. We'll see what happens, but I'm sure they're not going to lose. So they're always under his eye. So nothing from the outside can ruin this. The ruin always comes from inside. You know, Abraham Lincoln once said that no foreign enemy will ever walk through the Blue Ridge Mountains or take a drink from the Ohio River. If the country goes down, it'll go down from within. No foreign enemy is going to come and do it. So there was this beautiful vineyard with a wall around it. Nobody else could come in there. Under his protection, nothing from the outside could ruin it. So what happens? The ground is broken up. It's plowed. You can't just plant the thing. You have to break up the ground. The stones are cleared out. In other words, everything's made ready. Being ready for the fruitfulness, ready to bring fruit. And he says, the best vines are planted. Not like some cheap grapevine that, you know, they bought at Lowe's or Menards or someplace. The best, choicest vines are planted. So it's a fruitful hill. The ground is prepared. The stones are gone out. There's a wall built around it. There's a tower and a wine press. And the best grapevines are planted. Nothing more should have been needed. All the conditions were perfect. There was a tower in the middle of it. And the tower was a way for a guard to overlook the area. You know, it was kind of like a security measure. Now, you know, in the Torah, because of the laws God gave, some of the laws had to do with widows and orphans being able to take food out of fields. So you were only allowed to go through a vineyard once. If there was any grapes left behind, you couldn't go back and get them. They were for the widows and the orphans. You couldn't, you know, harvest the corners of the field. That was for women and for widows and orphans. Because unlike our time, if you were a young woman with some young kids and your husband died, you were in big trouble. So either your family helped you or you begged, or this is why Ruth and Naomi were gleaning in the fields outside of Bethlehem, because this is how they sustained themselves. When you harvest the nut trees, you only shook them once. If you left grain out in the field, you couldn't go back to get it. That was for the widows and the orphans. So if the guy said, hey, that's my grain, you can't have that, you would be violating the law. So the tower was a defense, and it was a place where the guard lived. It was a residence place for whoever was guarding the vineyard. And they would watch over the vineyard. So all this was made ready. And here's God overlooking everything. He says, it's everything here is under my protection. I'm watching everything. Nothing is going to upset this vineyard. And it's another kind of symbol, prefigurement of the temple. Well, not prefigurement, because there was a temple when Isaiah was writing. But it's kind of like a symbol of the temple. God meets his people there. The vineyard are his people. He met his people in the temple. Sometimes his very presence was there, if the Shekinah glory was there. But the law was there. The mercy seat on top of the ark was there. The Holy of Holies, where only the high priest could go in once a year with blood to atone for sin. All these things happened in the temple. And the wine press was related to this. There's so many messianic passages in the Psalms about I trod the wine press alone and my clothes were stained with the grapes. And this is about Jesus the Messiah suffering. And he has to do it alone. He doesn't suffer with anybody. He has to do it alone. And his clothes and his body are all stained with grapes. It's his blood. The blood of, wine is sometimes called the blood of the grapes. So all these things are messianic, and we can't get into all that, but maybe we will around Passover time. Ooh, I get excited around Passover time. So the wine press, of course, was needed to deal with the grapes after they ripened, but it also was a sign that Messiah was going to suffer. And there was an altar there for sacrifices, and they would bring the fruit there to be processed when it was ripe and picked, ripened when it was ripe and when they picked it. They brought it there so that they could run it through the wine press, just like Gethsemane was an olive press. So you pick the olives off the tree, there was an olive press there. And there were basically big stones grinding the olives into oil. And then there's a cute little canal that comes out of the bottom stone, and the oil goes into a jar. Pretty cool. I don't know how many olives it would take to make a quart of olive oil, but I would guess a lot. You guys probably know more about agriculture than I do. Just like, when you read about maple syrup, you have to have 38 gallons to make a gallon or whatever. So the fruits brought to this place, just like when you went to the temple with your sacrifice, the wine press was a symbol of those sacrifices. It was fruit, but it was going to be used for something. So it says he expected good fruit. The conditions were perfect. Good fruit. What's our fruit today? Well, when this TV show's over, maybe I'll read something in my Bible. Oh, I've been wanting to see this movie. When this movie's over, maybe I'll say a quick prayer before I go to bed. After all, I've been to church 48 times this year. That should count for something. Right, that's the kind of fruit we like to do. So he expected good fruit. Every preparation was made. Every advantage was there. So he expects good fruit because all the advantages are there. If you had a horrible, in American history, the reason there wasn't a lot of agriculture in New England was the soil was terrible. The reason there was a lot of agriculture in the South and then later in the Midwest, because the soil was good. So you don't expect to plant grapevines in some horrible place where the soil's terrible and expect really good grapes. But here, all the advantages were there, waiting for the grapes. So the expectations are reasonable. and just. In fact, God says, what more could I have done? What more could I have done? Now, you ever think about that in terms of people's salvation, individual people's salvation? What more could God have done? You know, in Romans, it says he didn't spare his own son so that we can be saved. In John 5, Jesus basically, around verse, I don't know, 37, 38, maybe it's 36, somewhere in the 30s. You know, Jesus says, you know, I didn't come here to be approved by men. I'm paraphrasing. Doesn't matter to me what people think about me. I'm here to save people. The reason I came is to save people. And he could look at the people who aren't believers. He could look at the people who aren't concerned and say, what more could I have done for you? What more do you want me to do? So here, the expectations are, there's going to be good grapes. There's going to be good fruit. It's, you know, I expect some discipleship. There should be faith. There should be fruit. People should be appreciative of all the things I've done. I've provided everything. The least you can do is to make the fruit, bring the fruit, study my word, pray, because I did everything else for you. There's really very little you have to do. That's why I say, you know, if you don't think about the cross 20 times a day, you don't get what happened there. You don't get what happened. So wild grapes came. You've probably seen wild grapes like grown in fields or just like these little, I mean, it looks like a bunch of grapes, but they're all kind of little and stupid looking. When I was a kid, we used to go out in fields and find these wild grapes. And everybody would take a taste of one and go, ew. Because generally they're sour and, you know, it's not something you want to take home and eat. So wild grapes came. Corrupt fruit came. Not the spiritual fruit that comes from the Spirit. Not the spiritual fruit that comes from the Holy Spirit acting on us. Wild fruit came, corrupt fruit. Oh, I know he wants me to do stuff, but you know what? I'm pretty busy. And I'm tired. You know, it's cold out. I'm not going out there. You know, read sometime in your spare time when you want to do some homework. I don't know if you like to read about, you know, kind of heroes of the faith, you know, great saints of the past. Read about Watchman Nee in China. Who's heard of Watchman Nee? Yeah, so awesome. His books are unbelievable. He also wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs. We were just talking about that. But this guy was a preacher and evangelist in China. The communists came to power. In 1952, they put him in prison. And in 1972, he died in prison. Never left the prison place. A lot of that time, he was in solitary confinement. They took his books. They took his Bible. A couple times a day, they'd give him some kind of slop to eat. And all he had was a bench. And he sat on the bench. He slept on the bench. Nothing to read, nothing to do. So when the guy died, they went to take him out of the cell, you know, to put the next guy in. Across the side of the bench was written, Jesus is Lord, that he had carved into the bench. That's all he had. But we say, I can't go to church because it's cold. Can't go to church because it's raining. Shut up, you wuss. Read about Watchman Nee. And you talk about suffering. And he didn't rail and scream against the communists and against the soldiers and against the guards. He sat there and prayed for 20 years. Then he died. I can't wait to meet him in heaven. What an amazing guy. So corrupt fruit came. You know, Deuteronomy 32, 32, it talks about when you get corrupt grapes, it turns into the wine of Sodom. Yuck. We won't get into Sodom and Gomorrah, but you all know about Sodom and Gomorrah. And you all know why the place was fried. And it wasn't because they weren't having good hospitality like modern teachers are teaching. Or they didn't have good hospitality. Now, that wasn't the reason. Read about it. But anyway, so it's called the wine of Sodom. And the wild fruit, in God's eyes, is worse than no fruit at all. That's not what he intends. You know, there's a, I can't remember where it is in the New Testament, where, you know, the tree's planted, doesn't make any fruit. And the servant says, should I cut it down? And the owner says, well, wait, let's give it a little more time. Put some more fertilizer. Go to Petites and get some kind of thing to put on it. And, you know, maybe next year it'll bear fruit. And then next year, you know, doesn't bear fruit. Should I cut it down? No, wait, let's give it another chance. Then after a period of time, it's not born any more fruit, get the axe. We're sick of this tree. Jesus was looking for figs. The tree didn't have any figs. He cursed the tree. The next day, it was all withered up. They didn't want just pretty trees. They wanted fruit. So the wild grapes, they look like grapes, but they're sour and they're bitter. You know, it's kind of like, the analogy of it is, it's like false religion. You know, you have the beautiful scriptures, you have the Torah and the prophets and the wisdom literature, then you have the gospels, you have the letters, you have the revelation, you have all of this unbelievable plan of salvation, all bound in the same book that people in some parts of the world would love to have. And we have, you know, like 7 or 8 of them in our house and a couple in the car, and we go, oh yeah, here's my Bible. And everybody, a lot of people in the world would love to have that Bible. They don't have any. Watchman Nee didn't even have a Bible in his cell the last few years of his life. He probably knew it by heart and probably recited it to himself. But, you know, the bitter fruit, the corrupt fruit, is like false religion. Yeah. I know about all that stuff. But I've evolved from that. I'm much more progressive and I'm much more intelligent than those people were. You know, God had to talk to those stupid people. You know, if he was talking to me, he wouldn't say all that stuff. He'd tell me something different. False religion, corrupt fruit, sour grapes, bitter grapes. The axe will be laid to the root of the tree. They're not true sacrifices. It's not true religion. Then God asks a question through Isaiah. And now, please, let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. Well, he asked the question, what more could I have done? So now he says, let me tell you what I'm going to do. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug. But there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. So God appeals to the people. What more could I have done? What more should I have done? Nobody else had all these advantages. God didn't expect fruit from the Gentiles. God didn't go to Greece and say, gee, you Greeks, how come you're not producing fruit? I mean, you got 582 gods. How come you're not doing? No, he expected fruit from his people. He expects fruit from us now. He expects fruit from his church. He doesn't expect the church to be sugarcoating the gospel everywhere. You know, as I saw recently, for those of you that are on Facebook, I don't know. You know, there was a thing about, you know, you can't be the salt of the earth if you sugarcoat the gospel. Oh, we'll just tell everybody what they want to hear. You know, if you tell people they're sinners, it makes them feel bad. You know, we can't have that kind of talk around here because everybody's got self-esteem. Well, guess what? You got no self-esteem. You have nothing of yourself. So he expects the church to produce fruit. We have thousands of times more advantage than the Israelite people had. Thousands of times. Because we have the full knowledge of the truth, the full knowledge of the plan of salvation. So when we corrupt that, we really cause corruption. And like I say, you know, nobody goes to more churches than I do. And when you hear some of these messages that are being preached now, you just kind of sit there going, what? So he expected good fruit. He got sour fruit. One thing for sure, it wasn't his fault. They couldn't say, well, you know what, Lord? How are we supposed to make fruit when you gave us this horrible ground or it didn't rain? Or these vines we planted, you know, why didn't you give us some good stuff? You know, we had to go to Home Depot to buy these. And they looked pretty bad. It's the people's fault. And this judgment that he does here shows that. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take down the wall. Nobody's going to till the ground. It's not going to rain on the ground anymore. Briars and thistles are going to grow. In other words, the vineyard that's enclosed in the within the wall is going to look just like the land around it. The world is going to come into the vineyard. After all, God wants us to be rich and healthy. Sign up here, you'll get a nice car. What about if you want to be my disciple? Deny yourself, pick up your cross, and follow me. Nobody quotes that anymore. We used to hear a lot more solid messages growing up than we're hearing now. And I wasn't even a believer then, but I was amazed. So the judgment's going to show this. No fruit? Even now, the axe is laid to the root of the tree. Therefore, every tree which does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. This, of course, is John the Baptist saying this. And the Pharisees, whoa, well, we're children of Abraham. You can't talk to us like that. Well, guess what, bub? God can raise children to Abraham from these rocks if he wants to. You know, in Romans, Paul says, you know, just because you got Abraham's blood in you doesn't make you true Israel. It's not a genetic, you know, faith is not a genetic thing. I always go back to an example, and it was in the early 90s. And Bill Clinton had just been elected. And I won't mention any names. I don't want to get in trouble with YouTube and Facebook. But he had one of his advisors, who's still around, a Greek guy with a long Greek name, was being interviewed by somebody. And I don't know how it came up. I don't remember. Somebody asked about his faith. And he said, well, you know, my father is a Greek Orthodox priest. And his father was a Greek Orthodox priest. So I don't think I have anything to worry about. And I kind of chuckled because I didn't understand. But you know what? It's not transmitted through your genes. You know, salvation doesn't come. You don't inherit salvation. You don't inherit the ability to make good fruit. You have to do that yourself. So there was judgment. All the advantages are taken away. You know what lo ami is? Not my people. They're not my people anymore. Remember the prophet Hosea had to marry a prostitute. Imagine he had to marry a prostitute. And she had to continue in her trade. And God said to Hosea, now you know how I feel. We think God overlooks everything. He doesn't overlook anything. Now you know how I feel. You're married to a prostitute, so am I. There's my people there, prostituting themselves, going after all this other stuff. So, you know, she has a son, and they name him, I can't remember the name, but it means no more mercy. And the next son is named Lo Ami, not my people. Ooh. And now, please, let me tell you what I will do. Let's review this. Take down its hedge, no more protection. And it'll be burned. Break down its wall. Trample down. I will lay it waste. No digging, no pruning, no rain. That's what's going to happen to the area inside. So he takes down the protection. The outside now comes in. The vineyard looks like the land around it. So they mixed with the nations. We mix with the sin of the world. Oh, wow. Oh, God doesn't care if I do that. Oh, Ten Commandments? What are you talking about? That's the law. We're not under law anymore. Oh, really? Well, we're not under law. But if you think, well, you know, he won't care if I blaspheme. He won't care if I steal. He won't care if I commit adultery. He won't care if I steal. But you're talking about walking on thin ice. So they mixed with the nations. They looked just like the nations. You ever notice in the land of Israel, and you guys have probably thought about this, when the people are in the land is great. When the people are out of the land, it becomes a desolate desert. You know, Mark Twain went in the 1860s and said, I didn't see a green thing. All I saw was sand and no people. Went to Jerusalem, the place was a dump. The people weren't there. Theodore Herzl, the father of Zionism, went to Jerusalem in 1890-something and said, this place is a hole. We need to find another land to go to. The British offered him land in East Africa. He said, why don't we just move all the Jews there? You can have your land there. He was thinking about it. Then he said, well, wait a minute. No, we have to have that land. People come back. And as Ariel Sharon said, we came back to a desert and now we export oranges. When you go to Israel and drive around, as you guys are going to see, you'd be driving through the Galilee and there's just beautiful farms and kibbutzes and green and trees. Then in the distance, you see this brown sand. And you say to yourself, that's the border. And sure enough, as you approach it, you know, border crossing, 1,000 meters, you know, outside of the land. But anyway, so no pruning, no digging, so the weeds grow up because of sin and disobedience. Micah 3:12 says, Zion will be plowed under and Jerusalem will be heaps. Happened in 586 BC. It happened in 70 AD. And it stayed a heap until actually 1967 in our time. I was learning how to drive in 1967, listening to the Arab-Israeli war on the radio as I was driving around. Because I thought, wow, those Israelis are kicking butt. They're outnumbered like 1,000 to 1, and they're winning. That's pretty cool. So then he talks about, and this is the end, I promise. Then he talks about what the story is here. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. Just in case you were wondering where this vineyard is, it's the house of Israel. And the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. They were the choice vines. I picked them. Jesus comes from the tribe of Judah, Yehuda. Jesus is the Lion of Judah. He's a lion. He's not a sissy man who puts up with everything. He's not a total pacifist who says, oh, well, whatever. He's a lion. The men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression. For righteousness, but behold, a cry for help. So he looked for fruit, none came. Expected righteousness, didn't get it. Instead of humility and meekness and love, he got pride, passion, discontent, and malice. The opposite of what he was expecting. What does he expect from the church? Righteousness, mercy, fruit. What does he get? Pride, passion, discontent, malice. I hate that guy. I don't like what he says. I don't have to put up with this. So they had rejection of the law, and ultimately they rejected the Messiah. In Deuteronomy, which we'll get to eventually, in Deuteronomy, I can't remember the chapter, but there's a passage that says, when you violate the law, there'll be consequences. When you do a worse violation, there'll be bad consequences. When you do the ultimate violations, there'll be exile. 722, the northern kingdom is destroyed because of idolatry. 586 BC, the southern kingdom is destroyed because of idolatry. 70 AD, everything is destroyed because they rejected the Messiah, which was the ultimate. And all of us non-covenant, unclean Gentiles heard these crazy messianic Jews preaching in Europe and in the Middle East and in Africa and wherever our ancestors were and came to faith in the Jewish Messiah. How cool is that? And in the land, most for the most part, they rejected the Messiah. Exile. Land is desolate. Because they didn't do what I told them to do. They didn't take advantage of the advantages. They didn't produce the fruit. If you read a lot of Isaiah, especially if you read Jeremiah and Ezekiel, you really learn a lesson of what happens. The priests worshiping idols in the temple and unbelievable. And we've seen plenty of that in our time. No matter what denomination you're in, you've seen scandal and anyway. Next week, we'll see how that applies to the church because Jesus himself does a story that actually follows this point by point.